Okay, this afternoon, 1 p.m., I'm supposed to give a talk on just some basic Buddhism in a nutshell. But somebody has left a question for me, and it's a question which is sometimes hard to fit in other contexts, so I'll deal with it now, if I might. Could you give your description of directed thought and evaluation with regard to the first jhana? This is the words vitakka vichara. Vitakka vichara can mean thought, can mean just consideration of that thought in some contexts. But as I was taught by Professor Warder, it's from him that I learned my Pali, that you never translate like word by word, but by phrase. And a good example of that is that when you translate the English phrase, "it was raining cats and dogs," you never think that cats and dogs are falling from the sky. It's an idiom. And when we understand what the idiom means, we would translate it was raining heavily. So we have to understand when it says vitakka vichara in the realms of the jhanas, there is no thought there possible. The mind is way too still. It is poised. What vitakka does mean, for those who get to those deep stages, the mind moves onto the object. It's a subverbal, very refined movement of the mind onto the object of bliss, which is the object which you are aware of. And the mind, because it has not got 100% confidence in the meditation object, it's got 99.9 almost, you have a lot of bliss, but you tend to just hold it. And because you hold it, the mind recedes away. It's a holding on to the bliss is called the vichara. And that because you hold on to it, it recedes. It's so strong it pulls you back in. I called it, and I think it's an accurate description, the wobble of the first jhana. And anyone who investigates these states, I will see that eventually you're still holding on to that bliss, but it's the holding on which you've got left is so small that you don't leave that object, you're right inside of it. And that is the state with vichara, you're holding on, but the mind never recedes away, and so the vitakka is gone. It's a state between the first and the second jhana, with the vichara, the holding on, but no vitakka. And then the vichara disappears. You don't need to hold on anymore. You have the full confidence. So you just stay with that bliss. And that becomes the second jhana. So vitakka vichara will never mean thinking. The mind is way too subtle to have anything which you can recognize as thought. You're beyond that. You're still peaceful and blissed out. But if anyone wants to discuss that later, I'd be very happy to. But what happens here, this is for those people who start reading about things like jhanas. They're immense states, they're powerful, and they are important. You cannot achieve enlightenment without a jhana. The Buddha says that. I'm not making this up myself. And so because of that, many people say, oh, well, yeah, yeah. They're a teacher, and that without them being able to say they have experience of a jhana, their students can say, well, you can't be enlightened then. So that a lot of times you see this, many teachers, senior practitioners, they kind of bend the truth. And I remember just going over to United States many years ago, and I was known, you know, as someone who teaches jhana. So I got these invitations from these senior Vipassana teachers over in United States, and then you know, for, you know, for tea. But I was wondering why they wanted to invite me for tea. And when they were inviting me, they started talking about jhanas. And I said, I didn't think you guys were interested in jhana. They said, yes, we are, because our teachers from the Burmese tradition were telling them that, you know, you have to do this jhanas. And so they were understanding it was really important they experienced these things, but they hadn't yet. So again, United States has always been very innovative. So it was the first time I heard the concept jhana light, L-I-T-E. In other words, it wasn't really jhana. But you know, oh, you know, it's close enough, isn't it? And the answer was no. I wasn't popular. But anyway, with Buddhism in a nutshell, this is some of those parts of Buddhism which I find quite fascinating. Other little parts, before I go on to the main talk, about having a fully ordained Buddhist nun here. And that's, again, there's no reason why not. We can have fully ordained Buddhist women. And again, I know my stuff from the Vinaya and in Pali. And when I first started studying, there's many things which came out. You can read it in the original. And there was no problem there at all. And so, you know, I was involved in an ordination of four women in Australia. And got into big trouble with it afterwards. But I'm willing to get into trouble because you know what's right, you know what's wrong. And you can't actually just take the easy way when it's going to affect and harm other beings. So that we went forth with that ordination. But to this day, I just cannot understand why that some senior monks or people who should know better say that it's not possible, and it's against the rules. It is according to the rules. It's just for some reason it's politically embarrassing. So anyhow, I am sometimes rebellious. That's how I grew up. And I don't mind rebelling for a good cause. And that's a good cause sitting next to me. Another little thing, I'm just wandering off here. You may see me when I come in here, I bow three times to the Buddha. Is that appropriate in Norway, to bow to a statue? In Australia, they're even more anti, what you might call, anti-rites and rituals. And many times when I first went there, they said, why do you bow to a Buddha statue? And I answered them in the following way, that when I bow three times to a Buddha statue, I don't bow to the statue. I bow to what it represents to me, what it means to me. And that is one of the reasons why, many years ago, when I was invited to give a talk at a top Christian school over in Australia, it was Christ Church Grammar School. And it may be, at the time, the top Christian school over in Perth. And when I went there, I knew the chaplain there very well. And I never knew the principal, the headmaster. But then the three of us had to meet together outside where I was going to give the talk, the headmaster, the chaplain, and myself. Just while everybody got settled in the main hall. And as they were getting settled, the headmaster, the principal, turned around and told me, this is a Christian school. And he said, in the hall we have a little statue of Jesus. So he said, when we go in there, the chaplain and I will do a bow to Jesus. You're a Buddhist monk. You don't need to bow to Jesus. And at that, the way he said it just made me rebellious again. So I looked at him and said, I demand my right to bow to your statue of Jesus. And of course, he was very, what's he doing? And then I told him what I would bow to. There will always be something in that statue which I respected. And that's what I was going to bow to. And I gave, you know, a lot of my talk, which I gave in that school, about why we bow to Buddha statues. When I bow, my first bow is to virtue, because I know how wonderful that is. My second bow is to peace. Peace in the mind, peace in your community, peace in this temple, especially peace in the heart, that's the deep meditations. And lastly, to compassion, to kindness. I really value those things. And so when I said that and explained it to him, he was very impressed. He organized a visit by his school children to our monastery. And I remember going into my cave where I live with some of those school children. And then as soon as they went in there, they were very impressed with the cave. And they said, this will be a great place for a rave. I'm sorry, but I'm meditating it here. You can't borrow it. But anyhow, when the principal came, I met him. He came alone in his car. And we both went into the Buddha hall. And the both of us, I never needed to ask him, the both of us bowed three times to the Buddha together. And he was a top Christian in Western Australia. He did that, he said, because as you bow to the statue of Jesus, because you saw something which you honoured in it, I am bowing to the statue of the Buddha, because I see something I can worship in it. And that's actually why we do these things. When you understand why, it's very easy to do. Worship means you find worth in it. And every time I bow those three bows, I remind myself of, you know, how important virtue is. You know, being trustworthy. You know, doing little things like turning up on time. Being kind. So that's part of the other. But, you know, being someone who is reliable. I will never say a bad word about anybody. We'll always tell the truth. Those things we put under virtue. And I don't know if you've ever encountered people who aren't virtuous. It makes life very difficult. When you encounter people you can trust, that makes life so easy and free. And like peace, we don't always agree with one another. We can make peace with one another and learn to coexist. And lastly, the acts of kindness, which there's not much light in Norway at this time of year. When you see an act of kindness, that really just makes the sun shine, even in the darkest of days. That's why I value kindness so much. So they become my three bows. So, as many of you, I was not born a Buddhist. I was, actually my father was an atheist. And the reason he was an atheist was he told me he saw too much suffering, you know, in the town of Liverpool during the Second World War. He said he couldn't accept there could be a powerful being who just stood by and let all this death and destruction and very painful destruction actually occur. And that was his argument. But anyway, somehow or other I knew that spirituality was important. And because it was important, I only started coming good at school, you know, in my last years there. I won my first school prize when I was about 15. And so I never had a school prize before in my life. So I wondered what I should do with it. You know what my teacher said? He said, go to the bookshop and get a book on mathematics. And then you can be even better at mathematics. So when I went to that bookshop, those books on mathematics, they were so boring. And I get those from the library, the school library or something. But this was in Foyle's bookshop in Charing Cross Road, on the opposite side of the road, in the annex. On the top story of the annex was the books on weird stuff. And it wasn't just weird stuff, it was books on Buddhism, books on Islam, books on all the different types of religions. And I thought, my idea was, if you are going to choose a spiritual path, it's like choosing a car to drive. Do what we call these days market research. So that's what I did. I read the different books of Buddhism, so not just Buddhism, of the religions which I could find. And of course the one which I liked the most was Buddhism. And it wasn't that it converted me. It was that what it expressed, I realized I'd been practicing and believed in for so many years. It's like I found a name for how I lived my life and wanted to live my life. And that name was Buddhism. And so because of that, why? You know, what is the essence of Buddhism which attracted a 15-year-old, a 16-year-old? It was little things like not depending upon a divine being. In other words, if you're in big trouble, should you pray to a god? If you do, sometimes nothing happens. I use my reason and logic. There are so many people suffering in the world. The poor old God must have his emails or his iPhone just jammed with so many messages. I still remember some funny stories from that time. That there was this priest, and he was in one of these churches during a flood. And so he climbed onto his roof during the flood, and a rescue boat came past. And they said to this priest, "Please jump in, we've come here to save you." And he replied, "No, I've got faith in God, God will save me." And they could not argue with him, so they had to go and help somebody else. So the rescue boat went somewhere else. The flood waters rose, and now he was on top of his steeple, you know, those pointy bits. And then he was on top of the steeple, and the rescue boat came past and said, "Look, the waters are still rising. Please jump in now, otherwise you'll drown." And he refused. "This is a test of my faith. God will save me." They couldn't make him jump in, so they went off to help somebody else. The flood waters rose, and now he was holding on to his TV aerial when a helicopter came past. And the helicopter shouted down at him, "Priest, you're a hero, you're very well known, your faith is great, now come on, grab the escape ladder, we'll save you." And he shouted up, "No need, I have faith in my God, he will save me." And they had his argument, and then they couldn't make him hold on to the escape ladder, so they flew off. You know what happened? He drowned. And once he drowned, he went up to heaven, and he was so angry. He went up to heaven, saw God, and said to God, "I trusted you, and you embarrassed me. Why?" You know the punchline of this story, don't you? You do, yeah. Anyone else know it? It's really difficult when you give all your talks on YouTube and people keep listening to them, so you know the stories and the punchlines. Anyway, the punchline was, and God replied to him, "What do you mean I didn't do anything to you? Didn't I send you two boats and a helicopter?" But anyhow, it was things like that never made any sense to me, and especially because I was studying science and eventually became a theoretical physicist. It also includes astrophysics. And then it didn't fit in at all. So because of that, when I started seeing that Buddhism was one of the religions which was not God-centric. In other words, that a good example of that is once this monk went to, he always wanted to find out where this world ends, where this universe ends. So he went to see one of these heavenly beings and said, where does the four, not the four elements, where does everything end without remainder? And then the lower god said, I don't know, but this other god's more senior to me, maybe they might know. And eventually went up to see Brahma, the equivalent, you know, of the head god in the universe. And then he asked God, where do the everything end without remainder? And the god replied, I am God, the chief, the creator, the everything, blah, blah, blah. And then the monk said, that's not what I asked. I asked, where does everything end without remainder? And then God replied, I am God, the chief, the creator, the forerunner. Look, I didn't ask that. Where does everything end without remainder? And then God took him aside and said, look, I don't know. Don't embarrass me. And he said, and monk, you're stupid. There's the Buddha down there. You should have asked him. He knows more than I do. And I kind of like that sense of humor being a bit sort of irreverent. But those are the sorts of things that you could ask questions and you can challenge. That's one of the other things I really liked about Buddhism. You can ask me anything. I may not know, but you're allowed to ask me. And if I don't know, and if it's a question which comes up after I leave and go back to Australia, you can always ask Ajahn Nito. I'll left you with all the hard questions to answer afterwards. So we always respect those questions. We don't ask anybody to believe anything. We empower you to find out for yourself. This is not a religion of belief. And I love that idea. There was, the Buddha's chief disciple was once asked a question by one of his sort of fellow monks. And then this monk said, well, I don't know yet. He said, but you're the chief disciple of the Buddha. He said, but I don't know, I haven't experienced it yet. Later on, that monk did experience it. But if you're something you haven't experienced yet, you don't really know, then of course you say that. You're much more respected as any teacher if you do tell the truth and that you say, well, I haven't got to that stage yet, maybe later on. In other words, the honesty was really more important than, you know, other types of existence. So because of those attitudes, to empower everybody to actually be able to know for yourself, that's one of the reasons why Buddhism stood out for me. And the way of learning was not through asceticism. When I was a young boy, I used to go to the church. It was an Anglican church. But the only reason I went to that church was because when I was young, I had a very good voice and I was part of the church choir. And the only reason I went to the church, because usually on Saturday mornings or Saturday afternoons, they would have weddings. And you'd be dressed up as a cute little choir boy, and you sing all these songs for the happy couple in their wedding. And I made sure I looked really cute and sang well, because they would give us tips. Honestly, the only reason I went there, because they say in London it was a good little earner. I got pocket money, which my parents never knew about, so I could spend whichever way I wanted, and just for looking cute. So anyhow, But everything else I always remember as being actually quite boring. Not just boring, but people just scaring the hell out of you, you know, by saying what will happen when you go to the hell realms and you will burn and you'll be tortured. And you, that really didn't impress me as a kid. And when I started looking at the Buddhist tales, then some people will do something terribly wrong, and still the Buddha would be kind to them. You have this story of that somebody was trying to kill the Buddha, and they said they got this big elephant and they fed the elephant with alcohol, and they set the elephant in the path of the Buddha when the Buddha was on alms round in this ancient city over in India. In those ancient cities, the streets are always very narrow. Do you still have some of the older parts of Oslo intact? These are places which horses can pass, but not cars. And so I often remember some of those small streets and lanes over in London, and imagine the Buddha going one way, and an elephant, a big elephant, drunk, charging in the opposite way. And as the elephant was charging down the road, people were running away. The elephant was killing people and smashing up things. And some of the people said to the Buddha, please, get out of the way. There's a big elephant coming in your direction. And many of the monks on that alms round, they did jump over the walls, go in the doors of the houses to escape from the path of the elephant. But left just the Buddha with his faithful attendant, Ananda, and the mad elephant was charging towards them. And Ananda, the attendant, stood in front of the Buddha. Let the elephant take me. I will sacrifice my life for my teacher. Would you do that, Venomanita? But the Buddha, okay, very nice, but please get out of the way, Ananda. I can deal with this. So it's just the Buddha and Ananda. No, the Buddha and this elephant coming together. And what did the Buddha do? The Buddha did have things like psychic powers. The Buddha could very easily grab the elephant by the trunk, really fast, swirl him three times around his head, throw that elephant over the Ganges River a long distance away. Could have done that. But that's not how Buddhas act. Instead, the Buddha would have said something like, elephant, the door of my heart is fully open to you. No matter what you ever do to me, you can smash me, trample me, you can take me in your trunk and smash me against the wall, but I will never take away my kindness and forgiveness to you. That is more powerful than any psychic power or physical strength. People can't harm you when you have that degree of kindness to them. And so what happened? According to the story, the elephant stopped in front of the Buddha, bowed down his head, and the Buddha stroked his trunk. There, there, elephant. There, there, elephant. And neither of them was harmed. Now, people may think I'm a crazy monk to believe such myths and old stories, but I've seen that too often, how that works. Oh, you stayed some time with Ajahn Gunhar, did you? Yeah. Ajahn Gunhar is still alive in Thailand. He was meditating in the jungle with a few other monks when a big king cobra came to see him. And this big king cobra came right up to him, lifted up its head, opened its hood, right in front of his nose. What would you do? Please forget about running. Those snakes are faster than you. That scared me when I first went to Thailand. I was told, just as an approximation, there are 100 species of snakes in Thailand. 99 of those species are venomous. If they bite you, you'll either get very sick, you'll probably die. The other one, the 100th one, strangles you to death. It was not reassuring. But anyway, the king cobra came up. And seeing them run so fast, even swim, I couldn't believe that. There was no escape. So what Ajahn Ganha did, he lifted up his hand and patted the cobra on the head. Thank you for visiting me. Thank you for visiting me. Could you do that? How do you know? Because anyway, he did that. And the cobra loved every minute of it. It's so rare to get your head patted if you're a cobra. So then the cobra apparently put his head down and then went to one of the other monks, lifted up its head, opened its hood. And that monk said, no way, go back to Ajahn Ganha. But that happened. And an extension of that, Ajahn Ganha came to spend the rains retreat at Bodhinyana Monastery in Perth many years ago. And this was a time we were just starting the monastery. And so we had our plans in the local council for our main meditation hall. And the mayor came to check us out. This was the mayor of the Shire of Serpentine Jaredale. He came in a suit, and being an Australian gentleman, he was even more rounded than I am. He was fat. And I just noticed his jacket, it was really straining at that button. That button could come off at any time. And when he came, I noticed him at a distance. Before I could get to the mayor, Ajahn Ganha went up to him. Ajahn Ganha could not speak any English. And what Ajahn Ganha did, he started giggling, Ajahn Ganha, and he took hold of his hand and started rubbing the mayor's tummy. And I thought, oh no, that is not the proper thing to do to a mayor, a senior person in the local government. I don't know, you have royalty in Norway. If you saw the queen or the king, and if they were a bit fat, would you be able to rub their tummy? I couldn't stop Ajahn Ganha. He was rubbing the tummy, and the mayor started giggling uncontrollably. The mayor loved every minute of it. He told me that afterwards. He became a really good friend. I remember going to the mayor's funeral many years later. And of course, we got all our plans approved. Thank you, Ajahn Ganha. There's other ways to deal with mayors and dangerous snakes. The kindness. Those are the sorts of things which kind of impressed you. It wasn't asking for help from outside of you, developing your own sort of abilities, these wonderful spiritual qualities of wisdom and kindness and peace and no fear. Another interesting quality of Ajahn Ganha is when he used to go on what we call the Dutanga, the wandering from place to place. And in those days, not that long ago, maybe 30 years ago, in those days, monks didn't have to worry about passports. So he wandered in the north of Thailand, you know, over the border into the Burmese part of Thailand. Well, not the Burmese part of Thailand, so into Burma. And he wandered in to an encampment. I forget what particular tribe it was, but they were communists fighting the Burmese military government. And when he wandered into their place, they were amazed that he'd just walked through one of their minefields. They were supposed to be protecting them from the military, but Ajahn Gandhar walked right through it, no problem. And number two, as soon as they saw that, they were quite impressed. Even though they were actually Christians, they weren't Buddhists. But he was such a lovely person, they invited him to stay the rains retreat with them. And he stayed there for the whole 3 months. They looked after him. He taught them, even though they were Christians, it didn't really matter about the name of your religion, because the goodness, the kindness and the wisdom were the most important. And at the end of the rains retreat, they invited him to stay longer. He said, no, I've got other people to teach. He has to go. They said, oh, we'll this time, just to be sure, we'll escort you through the minefield. We don't want to see you harmed. So they escorted him through the minefield and they wished him well and they went back. And a few minutes later, they came after him again, ran back to him and said, please, please, we miss you already. Please come and stay longer. And he said, no, I have to go and help others. But the idea of not having those distinctions, and that kindness is what you worship, wisdom and peace and virtue, that really impressed me. Even another example, that when I love going to conferences for many reasons. One of those reasons is it expands my experience. Sometimes as a Buddhist monk, you can live such a narrow life just with other Buddhists. And sometimes people like kind of worship you and they will never criticize you at all. Going to conference, you're opening yourself up to other areas where you can learn much more and make yourself vulnerable so you can learn more. I've been to some wonderful conferences. One of the most interesting conferences I ever went to was the 2019 World Computer Conference in Daejeon, South Korea. I gave the keynote address to this major conference. When I got the invitation, I thought, what are you inviting me for? And many people asked me, why are you giving the keynote address at the World Computer Conference in South Korea? And I told them the reason. Many, over 100 years ago now, in the St. Louis World's Fair in the United States, it was a big event for many days. And of course you had to supply the food for everyone who was visiting. So they had a stall selling ice cream, and it was situated just by chance right next to the stall which sold waffles, like the pancakey things, but waffles. So the two people, the one who owned the waffle store and the one who owned the ice cream store, they talked to each other, they became friends. And so they decided to collaborate. And once they collaborated and they joined a waffle with an ice cream, that was where the ice cream cone was first invented. An ice cream cone is a very thin waffle with an ice cream on the top. And that's true. Two totally different foodstuffs come together unexpectedly and you innovate something new. So that's what I told the people at this World Computer Conference. I know one gentleman I talked to. He was the head of cybersecurity for the European Union. Brilliant chap with huge amounts of responsibility. That was quite a few years ago. I'm not quite sure if he's still in his job. But nevertheless, they appreciated the idea of how innovation works. You meet with people you never met before. You get ideas which you never thought would be relevant to you, but they are. So anyway, that type of openness, it was also very helpful that we got a $2,000 donation to our monastery. Another, as I say, good little earner. Just for about a quarter of an hour's talk. Anyway, the whole idea of Buddhism is empowering everybody to do better every time and to create more harmony, to take down those barriers which separate people. And so there was another time when I was giving at a conference. This was in my local university. And at that conference, it was a chaplaincy conference, and I was presenting with another one of my friends who was the abbot of the Benedictine monastery in Perth. There was only two real monasteries in Perth, the Buddhist one and the Benedictine one. And so we did many events together and we became quite close friends. So much so that when he died at his funeral mass, the other monks said, "You must come and give us one of the speeches." The only non-Christian there. And they said, "You have to come because you were two of such good friends." And I did that. But even beforehand, at this conference on chaplaincy that we presented together, and at the question time, I was asked a question by someone I recognized as an intellectual giant in Australia. His name was Father Frank Brennan. He was a Jesuit, and he was so smart that he was asked by the Australian government to chair a council to create a new human rights addition to the Australian Constitution. So when he put his hand up and said, "Can I ask you a question, Ajahn Brahm?" It had to be a question, it had to be an answer with no jokes. Because I do know intellectual people don't appreciate my sense of humour. So anyway, his question, you know, he trusted me, so he asked me, "Ajahn Brahm, what is the Buddhist idea of God?" It was an important idea for him. He wanted to know what a Buddhist, a senior Buddhist, thought of the idea of God. And so I replied to him that my friend who I was co-presenting with, this Benedictine abbot Placid, I said, he's often said to me something I've often rejected, but he often says to me that his core belief is that everybody is searching for God. Pause, don't react. Because I used to react to that. I said, no, that's not true. But then I said, let's respect what he said. If everybody is searching for God, what are all you here in this hall searching for? What do atheists search for? What is Ajahn Nito searching for? And I can start saying things which I think I'm accurate in saying. You're all searching for respect, no matter who you are and what stage of life, that people respect you and accept you're not perfect, but you are working towards that perfection in whatever way you feel it in your life. That you all want to be loved and give that love to others. You're searching for love. You're searching for truth. To understand what this life is all about and why. Understanding wisdom. Searching for freedom, for peace, in whichever way you experience that freedom and peace. You have a life to live. Yeah, you will make mistakes, but you want to be given that freedom to make those mistakes and learn from them. You know, you're searching for some happiness and comfort. So I said, well, that's all those Buddhists I know, what they're searching for. And if my friend keeps on saying that everybody is searching for God, so that's what God means. God means respect. given to you and given to others. People of different gender specifications. People of different lifestyles. You're looking for love, for peace, for the sense of freedom, whatever that means. And then, you know, I was very pleased because this was a very senior intellectual. If I made any mistake, he would pick it up. And I'd be in a big argument for a long time. But more than that, he said, oh, that's a good answer, thank you. What it did was take barriers down between people. To take those walls off. Because it's those walls which create so much difficulty in our world and in our communities. So that's what I kind of liked about Buddhism, what it really means. It's not like you isolate yourself. We do for times on retreats. We don't separate ourselves in all the different types of Buddhism. What food did you eat today for lunch? Falafel, is that Norwegian? Did you object? This is not Norwegian food? Of course not. Because we live in a lovely world today where we can enjoy different types of cuisine. You know what I ate today? What was it? Fish cakes and potatoes. Norwegian. So whatever it is. So you can see that we live in a world where we respect different types of food, different types of ideas, as long as they're not going to make us sick afterwards. So in other words, this is something which Buddhism was telling me when I first started investigating it. How to be harmonious and make peace, and how to actually understand why. And of course, that was the best thing about the Dhamma, the Buddhism. It didn't matter what type of Buddhism, as long as it was authentic to how the Buddha taught, and it led to you being empowered to find out the truth. Quite frankly, Venerable, the only reason why I didn't join a Tibetan monastery, because the Thai monastery in London, the monks there smiled more. Now each one of you, would you ever like to go to a temple where the monks were miserable or the nuns were scowling? Of course not. Because I thought that if this path was worthwhile, it would bring you to a sense of happiness and joy. And of course, I followed that path, and it does lead to happiness and joy, and there's a good reason for that. You start to learn for yourself, empower your wisdom to find out, why on earth do we suffer? I mentioned this a few days ago in England. I've given so many talks in my life. You have to find a new subject every now and again. So one of my favorite talks, which I concocted, was Buddhism and bananas. And Buddhism and bananas. What's bananas got to do with Buddhism? I said, first of all, did you have a banana today? We had bananas today, but they're already peeled and cut for us. But if you have a banana, how do you peel that banana? Many people peel it, or they break off the top part, the stalk. Is that correct? Who are the experts on bananas? The monkeys, yeah. They eat so many more bananas than you do. So why not do some research and find out how monkeys eat bananas? And you'll find they'll always peel it from the flower side. It's easier to open. Not like us stupid human beings. We think we know better. We think we know how to open bananas, but the monkeys know much better than us. They open it from the easier side. So, who knows how to teach mindfulness and meditation? Who are the experts? The lay teachers or the monks and nuns? We are the professionals. Okay, we do this all the time. So because of that, the trouble is with the monks and nuns, we don't charge. That's a big problem. Because many times I was called up. Remember these calls. One time somebody called me and they said, "Are you teaching meditation tonight?" I said, "Yes." "How much do you charge?" "Nothing." "Well, you can't be any good then." People always equate how expensive it is to how good it is. And that's totally wrong. So anyway, when I teach meditation, my goal of teaching meditation or teaching Buddhism, my goal is to get rid of you. To give you all the information so you can find out for yourself so you don't ever need to come back to a temple ever again. So if I see many of you next time I visit Oslo, I'll be very disappointed. That's true. Why do you teach in a school? To get rid of your students so they can live independent of you, wise and free. So that idea of empowering you rather than keeping you, controlling you, was a wonderful idea. I'm a very bad teacher. Because you know, some people, they've come all the way over from the United States to hear me. I think I taught you before on the internet, but it didn't work. So you come back again. I call you Dhamma stalkers. You're stalking me. It's true. Anyway, so and the way of empowering you is teaching you how to, okay, to meditate, to let go, to make your mind so peaceful and powerful. It's amazing what you can do. This is just, again, another story. This was when I was doing my final exams at Cambridge in theoretical physics. I don't think I said this last night. If I said something this morning at Anita, which I've already said, please let me know. Okay. I like talking to elderly people because I can tell the same story again and again and again. And they think it's for the first time. Anyway, this was the time when, you know, I was a Buddhist, but I never ever thought I'd become a monk. And so I thought it was important to do well in the examinations. And this is what happens. That you did the morning, this was examinations in theoretical physics, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, 6 days in a row. 3 hour exam in the morning, hour for lunch, 3 hour in the afternoon. I don't think they do that anymore because that was just way too much. So anyway, after every morning exam, I never had any lunch. Instead, I went back to my room, sat down and meditated for half an hour. By this time, I was already meditating. Not long, but long enough and new enough to be able to, you know, get people reasonably rested. You know what happened when I first closed my eyes and sat on my, basically it was a mat with a cushion on it. When I first sat down, I kept on thinking of the morning exam. How did I do? What a stupid thing that is to do. Whether it was right or wrong, the exam paper was in. I could not change it. It was finished, one way or the other. Thinking about it was no help at all. That's what I mean about thinking about the past. It doesn't help you. And it was also wasting a lot of my mental energy. After 3 hour exams in quantum theory or something, you're pretty tired. Your brain is all worn out. So I stopped thinking about the morning exam. You know what happened next? Afternoon exam. Worry about astrophysics of the galaxy exam. That was one of the subjects. Should I get out the books and study a little bit more? And I noticed something, and when I say this, many people agree with me. Anything you look at half an hour before an exam never comes up. Never, ever. You're wasting time. So I stopped worrying about the future exam. So I came into this wonderful present moment, like I keep talking about. It's part of Buddha's meditation practice for over 2,500 years. When you come into that present moment, the next thing I noticed, I never realized this, my body was shaking. I was nervous. I never thought of myself as a nervous person. This was final exams. I had a good excuse to be nervous. And I was tired as well. What shocked me was I hadn't noticed it. Just like other illnesses which you may have, you may not notice them because you're too busy to look. Or you're afraid to look. Well, once you notice yourself physically shaking, you could relax your body. And then the body became at ease again, it stopped shaking. And the last thing I noticed, it was only half an hour meditation, I noticed how tired my brain was. I'd done a huge amount of intellectual work and my brain was exhausted. I noticed many people, whether it's in Norway or London or many parts of our modern world, physically they look fit, but mentally you're so tired. You've exhausted yourself solving the problems of your day or your week. When I saw how tired I was, I could just stay with that tiredness. And then I could energize my mind again. I wasn't fighting it, I was just being kind to my mind. And once I was kind to my mind, energies came back again. I've often used that example of how to overcome things like depression. Depression is an intense tiredness of your brain. You've been working too hard, thinking too much. You get so tired. And sometimes that you carry on thinking. You carry on trying to find solutions to your depression. That just makes your mind even doubly depressed, less energy. And soon your energy is so low, it's like there's hardly any electricity for the lights. Everything looks grey. Whatever food you eat is tasteless. Nothing stimulates you because your brain is exhausted. That's one of the reasons why the meditation, if you know how to do it properly, can re-energize you. So all that power which you once had can return. You can think clearly. You can taste the falafel and taste the beautiful flavors in it. You can see just the forest, even in winter in Norway, and it's delightful. You get energized. So that's what I did to my brain in the last part of the meditation. So after I came out of meditation and I went to the afternoon exams, I always did well. And it was something my friends told me afterwards. They never told me at the time. They said I was the only student who went into the afternoon exams smiling. If you watch your kids or students go into examinations, are they smiling or are they terrified? They feel look terrified, don't they? I was smiling. And the reason, I said, why didn't you tell me that at the time? Well, they said, we thought you were cheating. We didn't want to be implicated in the crime. I suppose I was cheating, but fairly. I knew something which the other students didn't know, how to energize and clear your mind. And I've taught that so often over the past years. even more recently, to the Jewish school in Australia, Carmel School. I knew the chaplain there. He was Moshe Bernstein. He was a really nice fellow. Because I remember when I first saw him, he said, "Oh yeah, we believe in reincarnation too." "You're Jewish?" He said, "Yes, but we do." And I remember seeing another sort of the senior rabbis in Australia. And then I said, "Well, I didn't realize you believed in reincarnation." The senior rabbi said, "We don't." "Well, Moshe Bernstein says we do." "Yeah, but you know, he's a bit weird." That's why I liked him, honestly. So anyway, he was the chaplain of the school for 1 year. And so I went there on his invitation to teach how to pass exams. And it worked. I got this letter back from the principal a few weeks later. He said, "Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for teaching our students." And it was just a wonderful thing. I don't mind saying praise. It's not about me. It's about this path. He said that this year we got the top school award in Western Australia. Best exam results. Thank you. And that's true. So, this actually works. And that's why I liked Buddhism. Even little things, like I've told all these amazing stories, and some of them involve me. And just this last one, why do I say things which praise me? Isn't that sort of wrong, praising yourself, especially in public? This is a little teaching about Buddhism. It's okay to praise yourself. And where I learned that was some years ago. I was awarded this prize by one of the local universities. And so I had to go to the university to receive the prize. And part of, you know, getting these prizes, you have to give a speech. And so my speech was basically, "I don't know why you've given me this prize. There's many other people in the community who've done much more powerful work than I've ever done. And number two, I couldn't have done this without the help of, you know, all my assistants and friends. But thank you anyway." And then the next year, because I was a prize winner the year before, I went to the next year's prize winner. It was this professor at one of our big hospitals in Perth. And this professor, he was the head hematologist, you know, the blood expert, basically. And he had the responsibility of dealing with people with many types of cancer. And he noticed some with people in the cancer wards of this hospital. They were getting the best, you know, surgery, radiation therapy, chemotherapy. It was brilliant. But when they left the hospital, they just walked out without what we these days called aftercare. So he used his influence as one of the head doctors in this big hospital. He cleared out two or three rooms, get some space, and he got a sponsor, which was, at the time, I don't mind mentioning them, Brown's Dairy, to sponsor an aftercare center where any patient who came in for any cancer treatment could go in there for free and get homeopathy, Reiki, reflexology. He said to me, anything weird was allowed in there. And he was putting his reputation at risk. But he said, he doesn't know whether Reiki works or foot massage works or any of this other stuff works, but at least somebody was talking to you and being kind to you for maybe half an hour or an hour without any time constraints, because it was all for free. He said that was the reason why that he put this place into operation. He stood by it, even though many of his colleagues thought he'd gone cuckoo, gone mad. And he did the research and found it did have a huge effect on the recovery rate of the patients. If any of you have ever suffered from cancer or any other serious illness, just somebody just being kind to you afterwards. You're not just like a car going into a service in the garage. You're a human being who feels. And kindness is so powerful. So anyway, he got his award the year after I did. So I thought, he's a hero. I thought, what's he done? He's helped so many people. And he put his reputation on the line for that. And it worked. Well done. And when he got his prize, you know what he said in his speech? There are other people in the hospital who do much better work than I do. I don't know why you give me this award. And I couldn't have done it anyway without all the other people to help me. And I thought, that's my speech last year. And it's everybody's speech. Whenever you get a prize, an award, when people recognize you for your legitimate help and service, why can't we receive that? It says, oh, no, it's not me. And I'm just doing my job. I couldn't have done that without the help of others. No, you did it. But they criticize you. You lazy, good for nothing. You ate too much at lunch. You fell asleep during the meditation. Blah, blah. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Why is it that human beings receive criticism easily? But when someone gives us legitimate praise, we don't receive it. Why? So please make a resolution from today on. If anybody praises you, say, yes, I deserve that. You've been a great retreat manager, Ajahn Nito, has he? Come on, let's hear it properly. Yes. Yes. Can you receive that? Okay, that's not good enough. You've been very kind, allowing us to use this center, Venerable. Thank you. Can you receive that?
Sure.
Okay. Good. Excellent. So this is what I liked about Buddhism. It made it far more fun. And it became a path with a heart, a path with joy. A path where we could tell bad jokes and make people laugh. A place where we could relate to people. You never felt afraid. A place you could have comfortable chairs instead of torturing yourself. A place where you can make really good friends and trust them because we're based on virtue. And that's why I really love this path. So that's the first part of Buddhism in a nutshell. And I hope you found it useful. It's over an hour I've been talking. Did it feel like an hour? Excellent. Sometimes when I heard sermons, I couldn't wait until they finished. So it's nice. You make it relevant, enjoyable, but also really useful. So you can go away from here after the retreat's finished, better human beings. And you know, if you want other people to follow this, people you love and care for, that is the best way to get other people to meditate or come to the temple. Not by what you say to them, but how you behave. Your partners in life, your friends, your relations, find out you're a very wonderful human being. You come to the temple, you're so much better. And because of that, they want to come as well. So I'm sorry, you have to get a bigger hall. Okay, thank you all for listening.